Paratext Chapter 15 on Smart Novelists and the Smart Set. In one sense, at any rate, it is more valuable to read bad literature than good literature. Good literature may tell us the mind of one man, but bad literature may tell us the mind of many men. A good novel tells us the truth about its hero, but a bad novel tells us the truth about its author. It does much more than that. It tells us the truth about its readers. And oddly enough, it tells us this all the more cynical and immoral be the motive of its manufacture. The more dishonest a book is as a book, the more honest it is as a public document. A sincere novel exhibits the simplicity of one particular man. An insincere novel exhibits the simplicity of mankind. The pedantic decisions and definable readjustments of man may be found in scrolls and statute books and scriptures, but men's basic assumptions and everlasting energies are to be found in penny dreadfuls and halfpenny novelettes. Thus a man, like many men of real culture in our day, might learn from a good literature nothing except the power to appreciate good literature. But from bad literature he might learn to govern empires and look over the map of mankind. There is one rather interesting example of this state of things in which the weaker literature is really the stronger and the stronger the weaker. It is the case of what may be called, for the sake of an approximate description, the literature of aristocracy, or, if you prefer the description, the literature of snobbishness. Now, if anyone wishes to find a really effective and comprehensible and permanent case for aristocracy, well and sincerely stated, let him read not the modern philosophical conservatives, not even Nietzsche. Let him read the Bauble novelettes. Of the case of Nietzsche, I am confessedly more doubtful. Nietzsche and the Bauble novelettes have both obviously the same fundamental character. They both worship the tall man with curling mustaches and Herculean bodily power, and they both worship him in a manner which is somewhat feminine and hysterical. Even here, however, the novelette easily maintains its philosophical superiority because it does attribute to the strong man those virtues which do commonly belong to him. Such virtues as laziness and kindliness and a rather reckless benevolence and a great dislike of hurting the weak. Nietzsche, on the other hand, attributes to the strong man that scorn against weakness which only exists among invalids. It is not, however, of the secondary merits of the great German philosopher, but of the primary merits of the Bauble's novelettes that is my present affair to speak. The picture of aristocracy in the popular sentimental novelette seems to me very satisfactory as a permanent political and philosophical guide. It may be inaccurate about details such as the title by which a baronet is addressed, or the width of a mountain chasm which a baronet can conveniently leap, but it is not a bad description of the general idea and intention of aristocracy as they exist in human affairs. The essential dream of aristocracy is magnificence and valor, and if the Family Herald supplement sometimes distorts or exaggerates these things, at least it does not fall short in them. It never errs by making the mountain chasm too narrow or the title of the baronet insufficiently impressive. But above this sane, reliable old literature of snobbishness, there has arisen in our time another kind of literature of snobbishness, which, with its much higher pretensions, seems to me worthy of very much less respect. Incidentally, if that matters, it is much better literature. But it is immeasurably worse philosophy, immeasurably worse ethics and politics, immeasurably worse vital rendering of aristocracy and humanity as they really are. From such books as those of which I wish now to speak, we can discover what a clever man can do with the idea of aristocracy. But from the Family Herald supplement literature, we can learn what the idea of aristocracy can do with a man who is not clever. And when we know that, we know English history. This new aristocratic fiction must have caught the attention of everybody who has read the best fiction for the last 15 years. It is that genuine or alleged literature of the smart set which represents that set as distinguished, not only by smart dresses, but by smart sayings. To the bad baronet, to the good baronet, to the romantic and misunderstood baronet, who is supposed to be a bad baronet, but is a good baronet, this school has added a conception undreamed of in the former years, the conception of an amusing baronet. The aristocrat is not merely to be taller than mortal men and stronger and handsomer, he is also to be more witty. He is the long man with the short epigram. Many eminent and deservedly eminent modern novelists must accept some responsibility for having supported this worst form of snobbishness, an intellectual snobbishness. The talented author of Dodo is responsible for having in some sense created the fashion as a fashion. Mr. Hitchens, in The Green Carnation, reaffirmed the strange idea that young noblemen talk well, though his case had some vague biographical foundation and in consequence an excuse. Mrs. Craig is considerably guilty in the matter, although, or rather because, she has combined the aristocratic note with a note of some moral and even religious sincerity. When you are saving a man's soul, even in a novel, it is indecent to mention that he is a gentleman. Nor can blame in this matter be altogether removed from a man of much greater ability, and a man who has proved his possession of the highest of human instinct, the romantic instinct, I mean Mr. Anthony Hope. In a galloping, impossible melodrama like The Prisoner of Zenda, the blood of kings fanned an excellent fantastic thread or theme. But the blood of kings is not a thing that can be taken seriously. And when, for example, Mr. Hope devotes so much serious and sympathetic study to the man called Tristram of Blent, a man who throughout burning boyhood thought of nothing but a silly old estate, we feel, even in Mr. Hope, the hint of this excessive concern about the oligarchic idea. It is hard for any ordinary person to feel so much interest in a young man whose whole aim is to own the House of Blent at the time when every other young man is owning the stars. Mr. Hope, however, is a very mild case, and in him there is not only an element of romance, but also a fine element of irony which warns us against taking all this elegance too seriously. Above all, he shows his sense in not making his nobleman so incredibly equipped with impromptu repartee. This habit of insisting on the wit of the wealthier classes is the last and most servile of all the servilities. It is, as I have said, immeasurably more contemptible than the snobbishness of the novelette which describes the nobleman as smiling like an Apollo or riding a mad elephant. These may be exaggerations of beauty and courage, but beauty and courage are the unconscious ideals of aristocrats, even of stupid aristocrats. The nobleman of the novelette may not be sketched with any very close or conscientious attention to the daily habits of noblemen, but he is something more important than a reality. He is a practical ideal. The gentleman of fiction may not copy the gentleman of real life, but the gentleman of real life is copying the gentleman of fiction. He may not be particularly good-looking, but he would rather be good-looking than anything else. He may not have ridden on a mad elephant, but he rides a pony as far as possible with an air as if he had. And upon the whole, the upper class not only especially desire these qualities of beauty and courage, but in some degree, at any rate, especially possess them. Thus, there is nothing really mean or sycophantic about the popular literature which makes all its marquees 7 feet high. It is snobbish, but it is not servile. Its exaggeration is based on an exuberant and honest admiration. Its honest admiration is based upon something which is, in some degree, at any rate, really there. The English lower classes do not fear the English upper classes in the least. Nobody could. They simply and freely and sentimentally worship them. The strength of the aristocracy is not in the aristocracy at all. It is in the slums. It is not in the House of Lords. It is not in the civil service. It is not in the government offices. It is not even in the huge and disproportionate monopoly of the English land. It is in a certain spirit. It is in the fact that when a navvy wishes to praise a man, it comes readily to his tongue to say that he has behaved like a gentleman. From a democratic point of view, he might as well say that he had behaved like a viscount. The oligarchic character of the modern English commonwealth does not rest, like many oligarchies, on the cruelty of the rich to the poor. It does not even rest on the kindness of the rich to the poor. It rests on the perennial and unfailing kindness of the poor to the rich. The snobbishness of bad literature, then, is not servile, but the snobbishness of good literature is servile. The old-fashioned halfpenny romance where the Duchess sparkled with diamonds was not servile, but the new romance where they sparkle with epigrams is servile. For in thus attributing a special and startling degree of intellect and conversational or controversial power to the upper classes, we are attributing something which is not especially their virtue, or even especially their aim. We are, in the words of Disraeli, who, being a genius and not a gentleman, has perhaps primarily to answer for the introduction of this method of flattering the gentry, we are performing the essential function of flattery, which is flattering the people for the qualities they have not got. Praise may be gigantic and insane without having any quality of flattery, so long as it is praise of something that is noticeably in existence. A man may say that a giraffe's head strikes the stars, or that a whale fills the German Ocean, and still be only on a rather excited state about a favorite animal. But when he begins to congratulate the giraffe on his feathers and the whale on the elegance of his legs, we find ourselves confronted with that social element which we call flattery. The middle and lower orders of London can sincerely, though not perhaps safely, admire the health and grace of the English aristocracy. And this, for the very simple reason that the aristocrats are, upon the whole, more healthy and graceful than the poor. But they cannot honestly admire the wit of the aristocrats. And this, for the simple reason that the aristocrats are not more witty than the poor, but a very great deal less so. A man does not hear, as in the smart novels, these gems of verbal felicity drop between diplomatists at dinner. Where he really does hear them is between two omnibus conductors in a block in Holborn. The witty peer whose impromptus fill the books of Mrs. Craig or Miss Fowler would, as a matter of fact, be torn to shreds in the art of conversation by the first bootblack he had the misfortune to fall afoul of. The poor are merely sentimental, and very excusably sentimental, if they praise the gentleman for having a ready hand and ready money. But they are strictly slaves and sycophants if they praise him for having a ready tongue. For that they have far more of themselves.